Welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Today we're going to look at immigration of Eastern Europeans to Chicago, and also the role the Port of Hamburg played in transporting them. Just a quick recap. Earlier in the series, we did two episodes on so-called German Chicago in the 1800s, and we learned rather quickly that it is hard or even impossible to use the term German immigrants to describe these people, because a unified Germany didn't really exist until 1871. So we ended up using the term ethnic Germans or German-speaking migrants or Germanic immigrants in order to describe these people. I just wanted to mention that again because today, as we learn about different Eastern European ethnic groups coming to Chicago in the late 1800s and early 1900s, we need to remember that Europe was in flux throughout this time period. Indeed, European borders didn't really settle until after World War II, and one could argue that they still aren't really settled. Look at Ukraine, for example. But there are also ongoing disputes in Serbia, Bosnia, Macedonia, and on the islands of Cyprus and Ireland. Anyway, the complex and at times chaotic political situation in Eastern Europe drove people from a variety of different ethnic groups to come to Chicago. And not every ethnic group had its own nation state that it could call home. But they did find a home in Chicago. As always, we like telling complicated stories on this podcast. And history is complicated. But here to explain it to you and me are two leading experts on Eastern European immigration to Chicago, Tobias Brinkmann and Dominic Pasiga. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tobias Brinkmann is the Malvin and Leah Bank Associate Professor of Jewish Studies and History at Penn State University and Director of the Jewish Studies Program. His book, Between Borders, The Great Jewish Migration from Eastern Europe, is forthcoming with Oxford University Press in 2024. He has done extensive research about Jewish history in Chicago, and his books, Sundays at Sinai, A Jewish Congregation in Chicago, was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award in 2012. Dominic Pasiga is Professor Emeritus in History at Columbia College Chicago, and the author of American Warsaw, The Rise, Fall, and Rebirth of Polish Chicago, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2019. He has written many other works on Chicago and its ethnic communities. He was lead researcher for the exhibit Back Home, Polish Chicago, at the Chicago History Museum, which he'll talk about later. And he is also curator of the Packing Town Museum in Chicago's Back of the Yards neighborhood. So here we're going to talk about Eastern European immigration to Chicago, and this is a long and complicated story. So now the hard job starts. Dominic, Tobias, where and when should we begin our story of Eastern European immigration to Chicago?
Well, you know, I would actually begin it in the 1850s, so just before the Civil War, because here you start to see the beginnings of Polish immigration. And even before that, you have the Czechs coming in somewhat of a number. And the Czechs sort of act as a bridge between Eastern and Western European immigration. They play a very crucial role for this development. And they and their fellow Slavs, the Poles, quickly become two of the most important ethnic groups in the city.
So now I already need to pause you. You're already referring to them as Poles and Czechs. There is no Czech Republic that back then. There is no Poland back then. So how do we make these determinations who these people are?
These are primarily Polish and Czech speakers, as there are Lithuanian speakers. There's no Lithuania. There are Belarusian speakers, but there's no Belarusian at this time either. And Ukraine is the same. Ruthenia, Ukraine is the same. There are very small groups that come that refer to themselves as Carpato Rusins. They come from the highlands of Ukraine and Slovakia. So there's a large group. These groups come and they create institutions in their neighborhoods that reflect their ethnicity and their language and their religion. And the religion is varied between Catholicism, Protestantism, Orthodox Christianity, and of course, Jewish religion. So there's this and there are shades of each one of these, right? There's, you know, very, very strict Orthodox Jewish religions groups, and others that German Jews will become more reformed over time. So all of these things have to be taken. It's a very complex story, as we said before.
But they define themselves based on their language, primarily,
and
then ethnicity. Or religion and ethnicity, although that can get pretty complicated.
And Andy, remember also that this is after the French Revolution, the rise of nationalism in Europe. And this is especially important in these nations that no longer exist politically, but had a history of existence. And they go back to these traditions. You know, the Czech language is almost disappearing by the middle of the 19th century, but it's revived by Czech nationalists. And becomes an important language in Central Europe overnight. So in Poland, which is divided between three different empires, the German Empire or the Prussian Empire originally, or Russian Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, especially in Austro-Hungary and Galicia, Polish becomes the language of the state, especially after 1863, I believe it is. There is a sort of state, underground state that's going on and creating itself and encouraging this nationalistic feeling. And then you have the rise of Zionism, as you know, Tobias can talk about.
Yeah, I feel I've done most of my work on Jews, and Jews don't fit so well into some of these categories. So for me, it's always religion that is a pretty good factor to determine where people belong. Ethnicity is very fluid, right? And okay, religion obviously has also shortcomings, because especially in the Jewish case, there were later in the 19th century Jews from the Russian Empire who very much defined themselves as not religious, as almost like anti-religious. And so it's tricky. But I think language and religion are initially the really important categories. And to make this even more complicated, many people, regardless whether they were Jewish, Catholic, or in some cases ethnic German-speaking Protestants from the Russian Empire, they were multilingual, so they spoke different languages. And we are, I think, also dealing a little bit with the problem with the scholarship. The scholarship is very much focused on nation-states as they developed in the late 19th century, 20th century in this region, and on ethnic groups in the American setting. And there's very relatively little work on the inter-ethnic contact that actually took place. And Chicago is a perfect laboratory of this. If you look, any look at the neighborhood shows that actually Jewish migrants, Polish speakers, Slovaks, and people who sort of fall in between some of these categories live door to door, and they work together. They, they were customers and clients of each other and so forth. My favorite example is not related to Chicago. It's Andy Warhol, the painter, right? He's often described as Slovak or Czechoslovak, or, you know, he was actually a member. His family belongs to these Ukrainians from the Subcarpathian Rus, so this Ukrainian mountain range. And so, you know, where does he fit? He was very observant. He went to church throughout his life. His mother often visited him in New York, and so, you know, he was not anti-religious, for instance. Most people don't actually know this. Mm-hmm. So many people fall in between. my own family history. My family is Masurian, right? They are not German and not Polish. Complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with the point you bring out about this sort of what I call spatial integration, but social segregation, so that each one of these groups has, as they build community, have their own church or synagogue, right, based on where they come from. But they have their own stores, taverns, fraternal organizations. They build this web that takes care of people basically from cradle to grave. So you have hospitals and all the way to cemeteries being developed in these communities. And that's very important. And there's still today, after, you know, over 100 years, basically, almost 100 years since the migration was cut off in the 1920s, an afterglow of this. Cemeteries are known as Polish cemeteries. The Lithuanian cemetery, even though the Catholic Church has taken the ethnic name off of the cemetery, everybody knows that St. Casimir's is the Lithuanian cemetery, and no Pole would be buried there, and no Lithuanian would be buried in the Resurrection Cemetery. And God forbid if anyone got buried in a German or a Czech. Well, Czechs and Poles own their cemeteries together in many cases, but in somebody else's ethnic group. So, I mean, actually, you know, you have funeral directors. If you're a Pole, you know God only speaks Polish, and you don't want to go to a funeral director who's Irish. He'll never get you past the pearly gates, right? So you need to have these things all worked out within your sense of community. So there's a communal response, but it is layered over each other because Jews live in neighborhoods that most people consider to be non-Jewish because they're merchants and so forth, and they work in the community. There are shuls in these neighborhoods, you know. Even though most people will say, oh, well, the Northwest Side was all Polish. Well, yes, it was Polish Jewish, it was Polish Christian, and it was a lot of other little things too thrown in together. So I think that is an important point that Tobias brings up.
I just also want to say, as somebody I'm the one who's not from Chicago, I've always been struck by the enormous fluctuation between these spaces. So on the one hand, the cemeteries are the only spaces that stay, but everything mm-hmm. else is in flux and within a decade or two. And that's for somebody who's not familiar with U.S. history, really striking in a sense, how quickly people leave neighborhoods, other immigrants move in, and then they're leaving. And sometimes the churches remain. Dominic can talk about the parishes, I think, that are so important. Some Catholics did not move because they were stuck to their... They really didn't want to give up their parish, especially on the south side, and then had to really very violent conflicts with African Americans who came in with the Great Migration during the First World War. So it's also a story of conflict and even violence, unfortunately. And so there's a lot of connection to the European context. We'll come to that maybe in a few minutes. The First World War sort of plays out in Chicago between these different groups. They're very strange coalitions forming, for instance, between Jews and the Irish, because they, you know, the Jews hate the Tsar in Russia, and the Irish don't like the British. So they form these short-lived coalitions, and Poles and Czechs are sort of on the margins. And then, of course, when the United States joins the war, the Poles and the Czechs are gaining, have the backing of the American state, and they take revenge. So it's a very complex mix, and African Americans are moving in during this time period, and they face a lot of hatred and violence during the First World War.
Yeah, well, you know, Chicago is a city of turmoil, and there's always been this conflict between these various groups. But there's also been cooperation on a certain level. Now, you know, if you take the neighborhood by the stockyards, if you put the stockyards in the middle of a circle with a 3-mile diameter, you could count over 30 Catholic churches in orbit around the stockyards. Now, why is that? Because the stockyard is such a magnet for immigrants, cheap labor. And they settle close by. They settle within walking distance of their jobs. So in back of the yards, there's 14. In Bridgeport, there's 10 Catholic parishes. Canaryville, there's only one because it's predominantly Irish. But in McKinley Park, there's another group. So you can collect almost over 30 Catholic parishes. And then if you add the Protestant parishes, and if you add some of the synagogues, for instance, Ratzfeld Zedek started in Canaryville, just to the east of the stockyards. There were shuls in back of the yards in Bridgeport and in McKinley Park. Most of them were small, and they were based on shtetls back in Eastern Europe. But it's very interesting to see this, because what you have is you have cooperation and yet competition. And this plays itself out in the political world as well.
Okay. What I want to do, though, is sort of go backwards. You started, Dominic, by talking about the Poles and the Czechs in the 1850s, and before I rudely interrupted you, as Chicagoans are most likely to do, and then we got off on a tangent. So let's just go back historically and just try to set the historical scene. Chicago in the 1850s is booming. I think I have to check my population figures, but it's doubling in size roughly every 10 years over the course of the last 70 years of the 1800s. So what's pushing, I guess, the Czechs and Poles, let's start with them, out of wherever they're living in Europe, what we would now call the Czech Republic and Poland, and into Chicago specifically, and what's pulling them into Chicago and pushing them out of Europe?
Well, remember, in the United States, we think of the railroads as opening the West. But in Europe, they opened the East. And so when the railroads begin to reach Warsaw, begin to reach Krakow, begin to reach Kiev, begin to reach Vilnius, that's when populations can suddenly move. It's a long walk from Krakow to Bremen or Hamburg, right? So you need this public transportation to take place. So once these railroads open up these lines, people can move. And remember also that I think in Eastern Europe, especially, it's going through a convulsion. I mean, feudalism hangs on longer in Eastern Europe than it does in the West. And once the capitalist revolution comes, it upsets many things. For instance, the biggest states are starting to break up. The peasants are freed, first in the German-occupied Poland, then in Austro-Hungarian-occupied Poland, and then finally in Russian Poland in 1863 to 1867. Peasants are freed from their serf obligations. So suddenly you have this ability to move around, but most importantly, the ability to buy land. Well, how do you buy land? First of all, the Polish economy was completely disrupted by the partitions because Danzig or Gdańsk was the major port for the Polish kingdom, even though it was primarily a German city. And yet that was all broken up with the Russian, German, and Austro-Hungarian partitions. So you have an economy that's trying to resurrect itself in many different kinds of ways. And the same, I think, is going over with Czech and Moravia and Slovakia. All these places are you know, starting to find themselves again in a nationalistic kind of way. You get the growth of the Free Thinkers movement in the Czech Republic, which is very important. It's based on the Free Thinker movement in Germany, actually. And in Poland, it becomes, since the occupying powers, except for the Austro-Hungarians, are not Catholic, the Catholic Church becomes a center of nationalism, of nationalist activity. This is especially true in the German partition, but also in the Russian partition. Austro-Hungarians are Catholic, but they're not too happy with Polish activities. But Galicia is ignored largely by Vienna for much of its existence. So by the 1850s, you get this movement of peoples. And there's a small, mostly when the Poles come to Chicago, they settle among Germans because they know Germans. And they're mostly coming from the German partition in the beginning because that's where the railroads reach first, you see. Later on, you'll get the Russian and Austro-Hungarian migrations shortly thereafter. So they settle in German neighborhoods because they know Germans. And there's actually clashes on the northwest side between German and Polish congregations. There's a St. Boniface church, which is now closed. There was a priest who was from he had served in the Polish part in the German partition of Poland in Western Poland, and he spoke Polish, so he greeted Polish parishioners. Some Germans disagreed with him on that, and there was almost a riot in the church during communion because he was giving communion to the Poles, and this ripped the church apart, and the Poles eventually settle and create their own church. So there's always this ethnic conflict, and yet there's this tremendous ethnic cooperation too, because in the South Chicago, the German community helps the Polish community when the Polish church burns down. So it's such a, you know, there's a wonderful Yiddish word. It's a mishigas. It's a mess. I mean, it really is. Of course, history is a mess. History is a constant mess. You have to, which it makes it most difficult, I think, sometimes to really look into this subject, because you come out with, well, this is going to happen, right? But no, it's not, because there's a, it curves and goes the other way. And intermarriage is kind of interesting. Poles and Czechs intermarry quite often. The Germans and the Irish, both rivals, intermarry quite often. And today, the largest groups that intermarry are the Poles and the Mexicans. Why? They share the same neighborhoods to a large part in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
And Catholicism.
And Catholicism.
They share Catholicism as well.
And their family system, the way they relate, brother to sister parents, is very much the same in both the Hispanic and the Polish culture. So it's in and the cult of the Virgin Mary, right? So that this is all becomes very, very important in uniting people one way or the other.
I just wanted to get back to the railroads. So I spent quite a bit of time thinking about that for my book about Jewish migration from Eastern Europe. And it's exactly true. The railroads are really a crucial factor. It's a very mixed blessing, actually, because the railroads connect this region, which is, you know, we would call it today structurally underdeveloped. It's most people are in farming. It's incredibly poor. There are repeated hunger crises when they're when their harvests are bad. There's one in Lithuania in 1868, 69 in the northeastern Poland, Lithuania today, and people die in the dozens. The railroads connected this region to globalizing markets for labor, services, information at a time, and this is also interesting, this is a global story, when slavery was being abolished. So there was a demand for cheap labor around the globe. So that explains why South Asians, Tamils from the south of India moved to the Caribbean to work in plantations, or Chinese migrants from the south of China start building the railroad out in the western half of North America, in Canada and the United States. And so what it does, it also displaces people from their traditional roles in these rural economies. So Jews are hit pretty hard because they're middlemen, men and women actually selling stuff on the road because they're not allowed to own land, for instance, in the Russian Empire. They're restricted to live in certain parts of the Russian Empire. And so they have to look for new opportunities. And the railroads, on the one hand, displace people, but they also offer a gate to a better future. And then I think the next part that is very important, it would be too simplistic to just talk about push and pull. That's sort of a traditional model that's very suggestive, but it's more complicated than that. I think that networks are very important. So I have one example of a Jewish migrant from just from outside of Kovno, who winds up in Chicago in 1880.
I'm sorry, where is that?
Kovno, today Kaunas, second largest city in Lithuania.
Okay.
From a tiny, tiny village, there's, you know, just 10 families or so, Jews and Catholics, so Lithuanian speaking. And he winds up in Chicago in 1881, and he'd already spent 10 years in Königsberg, today Kaliningrad in East Prussia. And when he comes to Chicago in 1881, this is very early for Jews from Lithuania, there's already somebody from his village, another Jew from his village called Breckstone. He's already in Chicago. So that gives you sort of a sense. And it's, you know, quite possible that they were connected in some way. And there's Breckstone, so this pioneer, there's already Breckstones in Scranton and New York at this point, right? So in the early 1880s. And networks are crucial. By the early 1890s, his four brothers, so this is the original migrant, Bernard Horridge was his name. He was an important Zionist in Chicago. He brought all of his brothers over, and he worked in the scrap business. So he picked up bottles in the streets, and the scrap business was a very important way for Jewish immigrants in Chicago in particular, and also in the vicinity of Chicago, to make a living. And it's kind of a dirty business, but it was a niche, and into the 50s and 60s, you have Jewish families in this scrap and trash business, which, you know, because it was a niche. And Jews had worked in these, you know, had experience with finding niches because they were excluded from many occupations. So networks are important, railroads. I just wanted to connect to a different story very quickly. Hamburg is a big part of the story because, and I explain this very quickly, most migrants could not leave the Russian Empire from Russian ports because the Russian Empire was very ambivalent. It did not permit emigration. It was very complicated to get a passport to leave the empire legally. So well over 90% of Jews, Poles, Lithuanians, Ukrainians, German speakers left the Russian Empire illegally, which meant they just went with a smuggler across the border that was not very well guarded. But that brought them into Prussia, so Imperial Germany. So they had to move from there. And that gave the two German steamship lines, which had long focused on emigration to America, the Hamburg America line and the North German Lloyd, a real advantage. They cut a deal with the Prussian state in the 1880s to essentially benefit them. So essentially, they were able to sideline competing steamship lines based in Rotterdam and Antwerp, and especially in England. And it's very complicated to explain this, but essentially, the Hamburg America line monopolized the passenger market in the Russian Empire. So that explains why many Poles, Ukrainians, I mentioned them, Jews from the Russian Empire, went through Hamburg, while many migrants from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, also Poles, also Jews, more Ukrainians, went through Bremen. So the lines sort of divided up the market. They had ticket agents across the region. And so basically, the typical journey took about two weeks or so. They walked a little bit. They took the train. They get off the train at the border. They cross it by foot. They get back on the train. The Prussian authorities leave them alone. They go by train, sometimes in sealed trains, all the way to Hamburg or Bremen. And then they go by ship, go to, often in the case of Chicago, actually not to New York, but to Canadian ports. So Quebec City, Montreal, and then they go by train to Chicago and other Midwestern cities. So that's a pretty established pattern. The migrants were somewhat overcharged, but the upside was also that the system was very well organized and the steamship lines had a real interest in taking as many people as possible. So in it's you know, again, too complex to say good and bad. It's there are upsides and downsides to the system, but it benefited most migrants. And many people also went back, I should say, for visits, or remigration was not insignificant. Remittances are important. So it's a, you know, Chicago is closer by 1900, by the early 1900s to Eastern Europe.
Yeah. Well, once again, I mean, the impact of steam, not only in railroads, but in steamships, which makes the trip across the Atlantic much safer, much easier, much shorter. But it's interesting because the German lines, the Hamburg line and so forth, and the German government, the imperial government, set up posts along the way to make sure that it was healthy immigrants who came. It was immigrants who could pass the American strict laws at Ellis Island, because they would be responsible for bringing them back if they did not get through Ellis Island. So there was this whole network of connections. And if you look at the immigrant letters, there were many letters were saved by my friend's father, Witold Kula, in Warsaw. Immigrant Polish letters were saved during the Nazi occupation because most of the archives were destroyed. But he was able to save these letters. These letters are a treasure trove. They've been translated into English as well. And these letters take you step by step. So you're talking about this sort of what we used to call chain migration. That's a term that's sort of fallen out of favor lately. But it was, you know, your cousin writing you and saying, you know, do this, don't do that. Be careful in New York because they steal your bags. Make sure you get on the right train, you know, and take you through the entire, in these letters, take you through the entire trip saying, this is what you have to do. I did this. Make sure you do that. You know, and there are people who prey on these immigrants. There's white slavery. There's pickpockets. There's people who say, let me shelter you to a hotel. Then they take you into an alley and beat you up and take your bags. So these letters are what's interesting, too, though, is they say, you know, bring your own sausage, because the sausage on the German ships, it tastes different than our sausage. You'll get sick. So make sure you bring your own sausage and you bring your own good, you know, beets and so forth. One thing we haven't talked about is foods. And because when we talk about ethnicity, we also have to talk about food. You know, I mean, this in New York and in Chicago, you can basically travel around the world by eating in different restaurants. and although this has changed somewhat in the last 10 years or so because of the outpouring of all these ethnic groups out into the suburbs, it's a really, as Tobias points out, it's a very complex relationship that's official, the German imperial rules and the American rules, but also unofficial, these letters that go back and forth between people saying, you know, my dear cousin, make sure you get on the train to Chicago, and they tell you how to go and where to go and how to, you know, get on board. And if you have a question, ask, you know, because many of them speak Polish in the area. So, you know, and so it's, then, you know, you come to downtown Chicago and you get out of the train station and talk about a mess. Where do you go? There's all kinds of examples of people saying, you know, they hear the first train is coming through Indiana. The conductor yells out East Chicago. They have no idea what East means, but they hear Chicago. So they get off the train and suddenly they're in Indiana, you know. Or they call out South Chicago when they want to get to the Northwest Side. They get off at 87th Street, and they're stuck. But fortunately, the Polish National Alliance and various Jewish groups, et cetera, had people at these stations saying, no, stay on the train, or we'll get you downtown, you know, whatever. So often, because immigrants moved around so much in the neighborhoods, you know, so they would rent a place for a room or a bed, and then get their own place and move it. So sometimes the only address that an immigrant would have would be the address of a tavern, of a saloon. So they would say, well, go to the saloon and I'll meet you there. And so saloon keepers are complaining because people are coming in with trunks, clothing, and coming into the saloon and, you know, and actually storing them at the saloon while they look for their cousins. One of the important things in this whole system are these semi-public institutions like taverns, stores, storefronts that cater to have a Polish sign in the window or a Yiddish sign in the window. People can come in, they can talk to people, they can connect. Some of this leads, we were talking about violence earlier. There was a great story in the Polish newspapers in 1916 of a German who had drunk a little too much and came into a Polish tavern. And there were 40 men in the tavern who proclaimed to the police that a miracle had occurred. A bottle had come to life, jumped off the shelf, hit this German in the head, dragged him out into the street, and dropped him into the gutter, and then came back in and reestablished itself as a bottle. And these 40 men said, this is absolutely what happened. So there's a report in the Polish newspaper, and the Polish newspaper at the bottom, it says, it's basically, Germans stay in your own taverns. And pity the Pole who walked into a Lithuanian tavern, or pity the Ukrainian who walked into a German tavern. So this was, once again, clashes and yet association and help with each other. So it's an intricate story.
Okay. Tobias, do you want to add something?
I just want to add one point that Dominic made or emphasized it. Before the First World War, what I call non-state actors, that sounds a little academic, but essentially steamship lines, humanitarian organizations, all sorts of actors were involved in this migration experience. The states were on the sidelines. The American state was concerned about disease. There was racism. There was probably a majority of the population supporting immigration restrictions by 1900. But the steamship lines were very eager for the business, and they were able to sideline the states for quite some time. And Dominic mentioned these control stations on the eastern border of Imperial Germany. They were entirely run by the steamship lines. So the Prussian state didn't have the money or the personnel, so they let the steamship lines handle it. And the steamship lines ensured that there were no problems. So any problematic migrant was... The steamship lines covered the cost. They organized a repatriation, which could be very difficult with the Russian authorities. So non-state actors are really important in this story, and that dramatically changes. So, by the way, no passports were required. You had to have some sort of paper. That changes dramatically in the First World War. So the First World War really is a turning point, not only because the United States moves to a very restrictive policy, effectively excluding most people born in Eastern Europe from coming to the United States. But after 1918 or 1917, 1914, migration is very much defined by the state or by different states. And that leads to all sorts of complications. There are stateless people and so forth. Before the First World War, people have, average people, even if they're poor, they have much more agency in moving to very distant places, you know, within networks, because that's how the way they fund these journeys, right? That's how very, most of the people we're talking about are very poor. They could not afford, ever have afforded these journeys. They depend on the networks. Somebody is paying the cost. Many migrants travel with prepaid tickets, and they come to Chicago.
I want to get to World War I in a minute, but first I want to go back to some subjects that we discussed in previous episodes. So in the German immigration episodes, we learned that the Chicago German language newspapers were quite influential. In fact, sometimes they would get news more quickly about what was happening in Germany and Chicago than people would in Germany, because the telegraph operated so well, and also because there was censorship in the German Empire. Then in our Black Chicago episode, we talked about the fact that the Chicago Defender, the Black Chicago newspaper, would go again on trains throughout the South, and people in the South would learn about what was happening in Chicago, because every day the porters who are on all these trains going throughout the South would have a copy of the Chicago Defender with them, or many copies, which they distribute, which would sort of encourage, I guess, through this networking model, to explain to people that Chicago is a place of opportunity. So two questions here. One is, we know about the importance of the Black Chicago newspapers and the German language newspapers. Was there a very robust Eastern European newspaper culture? And what was it doing? Did it have political biases? Well, you know, can you talk a little bit about how the foreign language newspapers worked with some of these communities?
Sure. My specialty, of course, is the Polish community. But there were various political divisions, okay, within the immigration. And some of these were also based on regional differences as well. But the Polish newspapers reflected a lot of these arguments. The Polish Roman Catholic Union was founded in the 1870s, and it defined what I call polskość, or Polishness, as you had to be Catholic and speak Polish to be Polish. Polish National Alliance said you can be Catholic, you can be Jewish, you can be Protestant, you can be an atheist, you can be a socialist. We don't care what you are as long as you believe in Poland. So here is this idea, a different idea, and it's reflected in the newspapers, the Polish Goda, and, you know, later the Zielonoświątkowe for the nationalists, and for the Polish Roman Catholic Union, the Dziennik Chicagowski, the Daily Chicagoan. And so these newspapers reflect that, and they have their own presses, and they publish and argue with each other constantly throughout this period. In fact, there's still an afterglow of that conflict still in Polonia. And the same is true with the Czechs. The Czech freethinkers have their own newspaper, Svornost. The Czech Catholics have the Deni Hlasitel, and they argue with each other constantly. The Lithuanians have various Catholic and nationalist newspapers as well, and some are socialist newspapers in the Lithuanian community as well. And so there is this constant kind of argument and conflict within those communities. So sometimes the outsiders look at it and say, well, they're all Poles, they're all Jews, they're all Lithuanians. They're all arguing with each other too. You know, you put they used to say this about Jews and also about Poles, but you put three East Europeans on an island, you get six newspapers and three radio stations, you know, because they have to argue. And of course, journalists are the intellectuals in the community, right? They're better trained, they speak better Polish, they write better. You know, the basic peasant immigrant maybe had a fourth, fifth grade education. These people have at least gone through a gymnasium, and they have more connections with Poland. And by the way, the connections between Poland, occupied Poland, especially Austro-Hungarian Poland, and Chicago are very important through journalism. And so that in 1890, let's see, the World's Fair in Chicago is 1893. There's a Polish day, and there's also a Czech day. But in 1894 is the Lviv, or what we call Lviv today, National Fair, in which Poles from all three partitions are invited to take part in, to show what Poland could be if it's resurrected. And the Poles in Chicago and in New York organized this huge exhibition in Lviv They build a building based on a Queen Anne-style house in Chicago, and they fill it full of memorabilia of Polish institutions in the United States. So every Catholic parish is represented, every fraternal organization, all these things. They find this to cooperate on, to prove. And the idea behind this is because, is the immigration lost to the homeland? Are these people now going to become American or something else? Brazilian, because there's a huge migration to Brazil as well. Are they lost to the homeland? And Polish Chicago and Polish New York basically sit back and say, no, we're not lost. We still believe in an independent and free Poland, and we're going to work for it. And they do. And every time Poland is under stress or danger, the Chicago Polonia responds. And this has been true throughout its history, all the way up to the Solidarity Movement and the joy that was experienced with the, you know, joining the European Union and NATO. So, you know, I think that that is a part of this bridge that we're talking about, or this connection between both places that is both formal and informal, and has developed over a long period of time.
Yeah, I just want to say the Chicago is a big center also for the Yiddish press, which emerges in the 1880s. There's a Yiddish daily newspaper. Just for the background, I mean, Chicago has a Jewish population of about 10,000 in 1880. By the mid-1920s, it's about 300,000. So that's almost as many as in Warsaw. And only New York towers over all of these centers. New York had 1.5 million in the 20s. But Chicago, Philadelphia, and Warsaw had over 300,000, or Chicago a little less, perhaps. This is a huge community. It's very diverse. You know, religion, people who are not religious, various political divisions. Some Jews belong to the business establishment. Most were working class. Many were moving into the middle class in the 20s. So there's also a very diverse newspaper and sort of media scene, radios beginning in this period. And what I find very interesting about the newspapers is they were really global. Dominic hinted at Brazil, you know, Poland. People took the papers back and forth. The papers printed stuff from other Polish-speaking or in Yiddish papers around the world. And so the readers really had a global sense of belonging, in a sense that they, in the Jewish case, belong to a diaspora. And that develops also in this period, in the second half of the 19th century already. So before, you know, people come from small places in Eastern Europe, they have a very limited sense of the world. And as they come to Chicago, and Chicago is all about small places and turf and fighting over turf, they also have a sense that they're belonging to something much larger outside of Chicago, while they're also voters and involved in all these conflicts and political struggles that are defining that at the time. The newspapers are brokers. That's how I always see them. They're brokers between the old and the new. The one very famous paper that was edited in New York that also was sold in Chicago in large volumes, the Vorwärts, or the Daily Forward. The editor, Abraham Kahan, who's a really important figure, he had this famous advice column where he really encouraged readers to talk about taboo subjects like sex and, is it okay to do this in America or is it not so good? And he promoted Americanization. He really, and this is interesting, as an editor of a major Yiddish daily newspaper, he really pushed for adopting English, learning English. He was not at all sentimental about Yiddish. And of course, he was hated by others in the, in the Jewish community for that. So it's a very sort of vibrant and diverse, and often conflict is part of it, nasty cartoons, you know, and so on. The papers are really fun.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, during the Polish Dziennik Związkowy, which is the daily alliance from the Polish National Alliance, during the 1921-22 packing house strike, they have a very interesting cartoon when you bring up cartoons. During the strike, the meat packers, the packing houses look like castles with meat packers looking down on people while the workers are charging into the castle with torches as if it was Jacquerie, right? it was a peasant rebellion. And it is to an extent, you know? I mean, this is exactly, I mean, this, and the labor violence in Chicago is incredible. And this involves all these communities at all times. Yeah. And so, you know, the newspapers, I think, are central to this experience. There was even a newspaper called The Polish Jew in Chicago. And so these newspapers are, you know, arguing with each other over different kinds of issues all the time.
I want to get quickly to World War One, but before we get to World War One and then on to the Depression and World War Two, I just want to take a moment to talk about the role of women mm-hmm. in immigration. Jane Addams was involved, for example, in helping immigrants settle and immigrant women settle. And she was also involved in helping to negotiate between workers and management in various labor disputes and labor violence in Chicago. So could either of you talk a little bit about the role of women in these Eastern European migration patterns?
Well, you know, I think they play a very central role. And one of the things that I found in my research was that it was a liberating experience to leave the village and to leave the tradition behind. So, you know, when Polish peasant women migrated to Chicago, many of them came as single young women, and they could marry who they wanted. Their parents couldn't say, no, you have to marry, you know, Jan down the block because we've made this deal with families. And so they could marry who they wanted to. They did not have to, in Poland, the woman would have to move into her mother-in-law's house at the wedding. Many peasant families had to live with their mother-in-law. And the mother-in-law still ran the house. She was the queen of the house, no matter what. So now these women have their own setting up their own households in places like Chicago. This gives them a tremendous amount of freedom. And you can see feminist movements taking place, the Polish Women's Alliance, because Polish nationalized Polish Roman Catholic Union do not allow unmarried women to join. They can only join if their husbands join. And so they set up the Polish Women's Alliance, which sets up this largely feminist organization that fights for women's rights as well. And so it's a liberating experience for many women. Now, it's also, some cases, a dreadful experience for women. I mean, many of them get involved in the garment industry, in the shmata trade, right? Both Polish and Jewish women get involved in the shmata trade and the sweatshops. There, in Pilsen, which was a largely Czech community, there are hundreds of small sweatshops by the 1880s, 1890s, employing Czechs and Slovaks and Poles and Jews. Maxwell Street, there are many sweatshops along on the West Side ghetto. So it's also in many ways a debilitating experience. But once again, in the creation of the labor unions and strikes and so forth and so on, Sidney Hillman, et cetera, coming to Chicago. So who, by the way, is from Lithuania originally. So, you know, you have this tremendous amount of impact by women. But the other thing is that, interestingly enough, in intermarriages, inter-ethnic marriages, children tend to be raised by the women, right? Because the men are off. And so if it's a Polish-Czech wedding, the mother's Czech, the kid is raised Czech. It's interesting to see how these things play out over time.
I think that the change in work, just occupation, is dramatic, right? It's people moving to the city. People who were farmers or subsistence farmers become industrial workers. And for women, the women had to work. Mm-hmm. So the employment of women is very high. They didn't stay at home. And you mentioned the garment trade. So first of all, in Chicago, there was a lot of violence over labor. So beginning mm-hmm. there's 1877, and we have the Haymarket, which I'm sure you talked about in previous podcasts. And 1893, the Pullman strike. And then in 1910 was a big garment worker strike, 1911, which was very violent. And it actually begins with a woman called Hannah Shapiro, very young. She was 19. She later actually married Sidney Hillman. It's sort mm-hmm. of a moment, that's the beginning of one of the most important unions in American history. Mm-hmm. And what happens, the employers are mostly Jews from Central Europe, from small villages not far from Frankfurt. And Kaiserslautern, sort of in the Palatinate. It's a network of these Jews, and they're almost all in the ready-to-wear menswear business. And Chicago and Rochester were the two big centers of producing suits, coats, hats, trousers, pants also. Most of the employees were Eastern European Jewish women and men, Polish women, and Italian immigrants as well. Mm-hmm. And in 1910, there were strikes in New York. Hannah Shapiro famously walks out because they weren't paid by the hour. They were paid by the pieces they fabricated, and the pay went lower and lower per piece. So she walked out, and there's a huge strike. And one of the employers, Josef Schaffner, very interesting man, was born in the United States, but his parents were immigrants from Germany. He crosses the line. This is really remarkable. Hart, Schaffner & Marx was one of the largest, actually, businesses in the United States at this point. They had a huge, what is called, inside shop where all of these menswear was produced. And he crosses the line and reaches a settlement with Sidney Hillman and the women. And that's a real turning point. So they never had any labor conflicts in the business because they set up arbitration courts in the business. And that's quite remarkable. And women play a decisive role in this. Already in the Haymarket riot, we have female groups of female workers participating in these demonstrations downtown in the Loop. So for women, this is a period of mobilization and on different levels. We have the trade unions. I can speak about the Jewish women. So the Jewish women's movement, Chicago is a central place. National Council of Jewish Women was essentially founded in Chicago. It's led by two Jewish women from Chicago in the beginning. And it's closely connected to the general women's movement in the United States. So these are established women who are, you know, very active in humanitarian work. Hull House is a big part of that. Jane Addams is from a, you know, solid middle-class family in Rockford, Illinois. And what is interesting about Jane Addams, I just want to mention that also, she did not understand the ethnic backgrounds, the religious backgrounds of these migrants. Her work was all about poverty. And she literally learned that when she started the settlement after spending time in London. So that's also a really fascinating story, how Hull House sort of plays into this. And it's a place of people learning from each other. It's really fascinating. It's not a one-sided, you know, Americanization story. It goes both ways. And the members of the establishment also learned about the immigrants. So that's, you know, and women were crucial in this. And they were not... They were central players.
And you know, also understand that there's a network of settlement houses across the city. There's the back of the yards, the University of Chicago Settlement House. There's Northwestern University Settlement House, Chicago Commons. There's a whole series of them. Some are religiously based, they're Protestant organizations. But many are secular. And, you know, this learning goes across the city wide because these people meet together. They create sociology, basically. They create sociology in the United States.
We have two episodes on Jane Addams and Hull House. I've begun to think of this whole podcast series as my own miniature Hull House, mm-hmm. as I'm learning more about the different immigrant groups and stuff. But we have to move on. I want to talk about World War I and then the interwar period and then World War II. Because these are important for a number of reasons, obviously, and we already touched on this briefly. The ethnic communities in Chicago were from places that are now at war in Europe, and when the U.S. joins, then they are Americans who are at war with some of their own ethnic communities in the old world. So how would you describe the World War I period first?
You know, the day before Austria invades Serbia, there's a rally at 26th in Albany in what was then called Czech California. Now we call it Little Village. But there was a big park there called Pilsen Park. It was connected to the Pilsen Brewery. And they had a huge rally there, mostly established by journalists, Czech journalists who had been banned and blacklisted in Vienna and in Prague. And so they came to the United States and they organized this, which in American became hilarious, right? Because the press was covering this and they had no idea what the hell was going on. They didn't know what the Czechs were, what Bohemians are, what, you know, and they're covering this rally. And so it's held in this Pilsen Park Pavilion. And on the ceilings of the pavilion are two Austrian symbols. That's because the Czechs had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and many had served in the Austro-Hungarian army, and so they were proud of their service at one point or another. And when the Czechs come in and see this, they try to get these symbols down, the two-headed eagle down from the ceiling, And so the Czech Sokols, which are the falcons, they create a human pyramid, climb up to the ceilings and rip these two symbols down. They throw them on the ground, and the Czechs, being a very orderly people, get in line by the thousands to step on them as they walk through the pavilion. And this showing of anti-Austrian demonstration. And the Americans are just like, what the hell are they doing? I mean, what's going on here? You know, what's this two-headed eagle? You know, the journalists in the United States have no idea what's going on here. But so at that point, then the Czech organizations the next day say they will refuse to. They're called in by the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Czechs of a certain age that are in the diaspora should come back and fight for the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Czechs say, no, we won't. And the Poles, of course, are divided because, you know, there's Russian Poles and Polish, German Poles and Austro-Hungarian Poles, and they're fighting each other on the Eastern Front, which is basically in Poland and in Ukraine. And it is much bloodier in many ways than the Western Front even. And eventually what happens, of course, is that the Poles decide they're on the side of the Entente, you know, the anti-German alliance. And they're convinced of that largely by the Czechs as well. You know, this becomes this idea of this is the way we can win independence. And Pilsudski, who organizes a Polish legion in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, eventually rebels and helps to create this state that emerges after 1918. So you've got these huge rallies in these communities to raise money, mostly for Polish relief. But the Poles in the United States also send an army of about 22,000 men to the Western Front under the Polish flag there. They are immigrants, and the United States allows them to be organized in the United and then sent over to Canada, and then under the French flag, they will fight in Western Europe, Polish and French flag in Western Europe. And then they'll transfer to Poland and fight against the Soviets. You know, the World War I doesn't really end in Poland until about 1921 because you have a Soviet attack, et cetera, the miracle of the Vistula and so forth. As I mentioned before, every time Poland's in danger or trying to create itself as an independent state, the Chicago Polonia reacts. Mostly it relaxed to relief. And Paderewski comes to Chicago, puts on these huge concerts. I mean, he's a wildly, you know, he's sort of like the John Lennon of the 19th and early 20th century. You know, he has this long red hair, and when he throws his hair back, women supposedly pass out as he's playing the piano. And he's wildly popular. He's a friend of many of the elite in Chicago. He stays at their homes. He plays on their Steinways. And so there are Paderewski Steinways all over Chicago, one place or the other that he tinkled on. But he and his wife raise a tremendous amount of money for war relief, which can, you know, because the Poles are now going to they're in the middle of this fighting. And it's almost a civil war in Poland, you know, because of the way Poland's partitioned. And so, you know, it's kind of amazing that there's a Czech army that walks across Siberia and gets on a boat in Vladivostok and comes to the United States. I mean, it's wild, wild stuff that most Americans don't have no idea about what's going on, you know. And the Jewish community is divided between German Jews and Polish Jews and, you know, Ukrainian Jews and Russian Jews. And in South Chicago, there are riots in the steel mills between Serbians and Germans and Austro-Hungarians, you know, and so, you know, because they're all working there. I mean, there's a large Hungarian community in the steel mill.
I want to let Tobias jump in here. But first, what we remember from the Germans is actually the war actually kind of was the one of the final nails in the coffin of Germanic culture, right, in the U.S. And one way that it was achieved was by putting these strict translation rules on German language newspapers, that they had to translate all their articles and get them posted to the government sort of like a day before publication, which is crazy. Just a quick factual question about that before we go to Tobias. Were any of the other foreign language newspapers in Chicago subjected to the same quasi-censorship, as it were, translation rules?
Yeah, I think they were. For instance, once again, the Poles, well, some of them were enemy aliens, right, after 1917, because they came from the German partition or the Austro-Hungarian partition. So they were considered enemy aliens. They had to register. And so their newspapers were also subjected to this kind of censorship. But I think with the East Europeans, who are on the rise politically at this time and culturally in the city, I mean, they will replace the Germans as the largest ethnic group in 1930. The Poles will. The Czechs are a smaller group, but they're also more powerful in many ways because they're more politically active and they became in the country longer. And so they have citizenship and they have generations that are growing up here that consider themselves Czech Americans, but are American citizens. They put a tremendous amount of pressure on the German community during World War One. I mean, there are street fights between gangs. German bakeries and butcher shops have their windows broken by Polish gangs. The Slavic students in Chicago rip out. There's a textbook that praises the Kaiser, and that's used in the Chicago public schools. And one day, and I think it's at 11 o'clock in the morning, all the Polish and Czech students stand up, rip that page out of the book, and throw it on the ground in the Chicago public schools. And so there's this antagonism. And the Czechs and the Poles push to get German removed from the curriculum in the public schools. German language was one of the honored languages in Chicago for a long time. They also pushed to have the name of Bismarck removed from a school and have it changed to somebody else's name. Not a Pole, but somebody else. I forget his name. He was a general in the Philippines someplace. And then, of course, you have in the post-World War era, there are pogroms in the new...
Let's stop right there. Tobias, did you want to make a point before we get into the interwar period?
Yeah, I just want to highlight again that it was very violent. It was really violent and messy in Chicago. So you could almost argue that the city is a little bit like a microcosm of the war. And I think it's important to remember that the American establishment, the people who are in charge in Washington, certainly sympathetic with Britain, but the cities were full of immigrants. In Chicago, in the beginning, in July and August 1914, and that would have been similar in Boston, actually, there's a lot of sympathy for the Germans, actually, because they, the Irish don't like Britain, and actually it unified the Jews, who had a lot of differences, but they all agreed that Russia was evil. And Austria-Hungary was not so bad. Jews were citizens in Austria-Hungary, not in the Russian Empire. And the people invested in this German community project had lost a lot of their influence. They saw this as their moment, and they overreached. You know, once the United States enters the war, of course, there's revenge. And I think that is also the beginning of the formation of the new Polish state. I think Dominic can speak more about this. Chicago is an important place for that, just like Pittsburgh is for the Czech case. Tomasz Masaryk, the later president of Czechoslovakia, visited Chicago also. And we haven't talked about Greece. I consider Greeks also as part of that. And these are all places that are really mired in this horrific war. And for average people, and Dominic hinted at this already, it's a disaster, right? So first of all, some people are volunteering. They get taken prisoner, and that leads to very complicated situations because they then actually renounce their citizenship and say they're actually Americans. It's very complicated to sort this out. And sending you support to families, many people had families, regardless whether they were Polish, Greek, Jewish, you name it. And initially, the United States was neutral. So I know for Jewish aid organizations, they sent aid to the Netherlands, which was also neutral. And then from the Netherlands, the German Jewish aid organization would take it to areas occupied in Lithuania and in Ukraine. And that obviously became very complicated in 1917 once the United States entered. And then there's also humanitarian aid provided to people, Jews who managed to flee all the way to Siberia. During the war, I just want to mention this briefly here, more than 1 million Armenians were killed in the Ottoman Empire. And there are a few Armenians in Chicago also. And at least 700,000 Jews were forcibly resettled by the Russian authorities from this area in Western Russia to the interior. And it's a complete disaster and mess. And that then, when the Russian Empire collapses into the civil war, between the Bolsheviks, the whites, and various groups, the formation of the Polish state, it's very bad for Jews. There's a lot of violence and pogroms. Tens of thousands of Jews are massacred in this period. That's little known. And all of that is very closely followed in major cities like Chicago. So this is a very difficult, divisive time. And I already mentioned the Great Migration. So there's more conflict as more African Americans move in and are brutally sort of, the people who live there try to prevent them from settling on the South Side in particular. 1919 is a notorious race riot in Chicago. And one leading rabbi who's connected to the business establishment compares it to the pogroms in Russia. So that it's a very difficult time also politically in Chicago.
This theme of conflict and cooperation that we established earlier, we see following us through each decade. Let's move on then to the interwar period, which I guess is inaccurate. As Dominic, as you argued, the war doesn't end until 1921 or even after with the pogroms. But let's just kind of try to summarize what's going on in Chicago with your Eastern European immigration between the wars. Are people realizing because of the Depression, say in the 30s, that maybe they want to move back to their old homes? What's going on, Dominic?
Well, I think, you know, right after the war, a large number of Poles move back. They repatriate to Poland, to new independent Poland. But it's a small number compared to the entire diaspora, the Polish diaspora in Chicago. What's happening in the 20s is, since immigration is cut off by congressional fiat in the middle of the decade, the communities begin to feel more under attack. And the Americanization process is really emphasized during the war, 1917 to 1918. They're doing all kinds of Americanization, and this continues, and the anti-immigrant feeling. So these communities begin to look inward to themselves to try to protect themselves, but they also begin to fade away the connection between the homeland and the Chicago ethnic community. So by the early 1930s, the Polish National Alliance is invited to a huge meeting in Warsaw, where they're supposed to join this international group of Polish organizations that covers wherever the diaspora is. And the Polish Chicagoans say, no, we're not going to do that. We are Americans of Polish descent. We're no longer Poles living in America. And that's a big break for the Polish National Alliance to an extent they felt they had accomplished their goals by helping to find an independent Poland. And now they were focused on what was going on in America, which was a good deal of anti-Polish feeling, anti-Catholic feeling, anti-Jewish feeling. You know, there were, you know, fascist groups growing in the United States as well, as we well know. And so they begin to turn inward and away from Poland to an extent. But then, of course, comes the rise of, you know, World War II, and that shifts the focus again back to Poland. And this time, not an army being organized, but massive relief being sent to Poland under occupation. And it's difficult because once the United States gets involved in World War II, right, then there's the conflict about can aid be sent to these occupied territories through that are now part of the Nazi occupation. And by the way, this plays out on the streets of Chicago again. In 1937, 1938, there are fights between Czechs and Germans over, annexation of Czechoslovakia. There are the Poles join them after 1939, especially. There were street fights between German-American Bund members and ethnic organizations. Riverview Park was supposed to be a huge Bund rally. It was supposed to be only for German-American Bund. And there were such protests by Jewish and Polish and Czech organizations that they had to move it to a Ukrainian park somewhere on the far northwest side. The Bund headquarters were right by Riverview Park. So it wasn't as big as in New York, but it was important. And so, you get these constant sort of clashes between these peoples. And this, as you said earlier, the sort of the last nail in the coffin of a German Deutschdom in Chicago was World War I, but World War II really seals it up.
Tobias, did you want to add something about this period? And then we'll get to the final points for today.
So for the Jewish period, for Jews in Chicago, this is a really important period. Because I already mentioned it's a very large community, 300,000. And I argue that the end of immigration, which of course was a disaster for those who couldn't come, and they're often not treated as part of American history, and I think they should. So there are desperate attempts to get people in, but obviously that's not possible. It also brings some stability, actually, and makes it easier to build overarching institutions, because in the period before 1914, there's so many people coming in the whole time and going back and coming in that makes it very hard to build coalitions. And that becomes easier in the 20s. So in the Jewish case, this is the beginning actually of an organized Jewish community that comprises all these different groups. And that's already rooted in the First World War, because that forces all these groups to come together to help Jews in Eastern Europe. And Zionism, which initially was very divisive, becomes more of a unifying force, actually, because there's sort of a compromise. Everybody supports it, but American Jews won't really go to Palestine themselves. So it's more a support project for Jews in Eastern Europe as a second option, because the United States is clearly not an option anymore. But of course, with the Great Depression, that's a disaster for all Chicagoans, regardless whether they're immigrants or not. For Jews, of course, the rise of the Nazi Party is very concerning. And again, I'd like to point out the United States pursued a very restrictive immigration policy that specifically targeted people born in Eastern Europe and in Southern Europe. So these people are often missing from the story, because we focus in Jewish history very much on German and Austrian Jews, who ironically benefited from this fairly generous quota that was in the 1924 law. And many Eastern European Jews never had a chance to come to the United States. And that also applies to Poles, to Ukrainians, and so on. This long list, Greeks, Italians, who probably would have survived World War II if they had a chance to move to the United States. But the impact of the 1921 and 1924 congressional bills on immigration should not be overestimated. It really changed everything in cities like Chicago that were full of immigrants. Just a small point, the congressman representing the West Side, which is Polish and Czech at this point, was actually Jewish, Adolf Sabbath, who was from Bohemia and very proud of his, sort of Czech and Jewish origins. And he represented Poles, and he spoke up often in favor of the Polish state, which is interesting because in the 20s and 30s, the Polish state, especially after the death of Pilsudski, promoted openly anti-Semitic policy. So it was quite a difficult situation for Sabbath. But what united him, what kept him in office, so he served until the 1950s, was his opposition to these immigration bills. And that was everybody signed up for that, regardless whether the voters were Polish, Czech, Jewish, you name it. So it's a difficult time.
You know, talking about opposition to the immigration laws, there was also opposition to prohibition. And because in German and Czech and Polish culture, alcohol was just part of life. And so Cermak actually built his machine around the idea of being, he was the wettest Democrat in America, right?
Just explain who Cermak is to our audience.
Cermak was the only immigrant mayor of the city of Chicago to this day. He was born in what was would become the Czechoslovak Republic, which now is the Czech Republic. And he put a coalition together of all these immigrant groups. He reached out to the Germans as well, especially after World War I. And he built this coalition that created the democratic machine in Chicago, which, by the way, even though it is no longer as powerful as it once was, is still, there's not been a Republican mayor of the city of Chicago since 1931. And no foreseeable Republican in the future is going to be mayor of the city of Chicago as well. So Cermak had created the machine, which gave us later on Richard J. Daley and the rest. But that coalition was built around opposition, as you say, to the immigration laws, but also to prohibition, which was also seen as an anti-immigrant measure because it was aimed at Eastern and Southern Europeans and their culture.
Interesting. All right, let's move on to World War II, and then of course we need to talk about the Cold War as our final two topics, but I think most of us probably know the history of the war itself. So can we just get to like 1945 and beyond and try to quickly summarize the rest of our story for today about Eastern European immigration?
Well, in this post-45 period, there is, of course, the displaced person issues. And the immigration laws are slightly changed temporarily to allow some of these people in. There were over a million Poles living in Germany in slave labor camps and concentration camps and POW camps during the war. Many of them felt they could not go back to Poland because Poland was now dominated by a communist regime. They felt they were anti-communist. The Polish underground was being decimated by the Russians and by the Polish communist machine regime at this time. And so they needed to go someplace, and they left largely for the United States. So there was a huge migration of Jews and Poles in this displaced persons time period. But then, of course, you know, Poland is now a communist state. Lithuania is part of the Soviet Union. Czech Republic is now, Czechoslovakia is a communist state. The Iron Curtain comes down across. And, you know, Stalin moved populations around like they were chess pieces. He took all of, you know, what today would be Western Poland, moved the Germans completely out, and moved Poles from Eastern, part of Poland, which became part of the Soviet Union. So places like Lviv or Lviv, and from parts of Lithuania, Vilnius was a Polish city occupied by the Poles between the wars. These people were moved westward to places like Breslau, Wrocław, and the Baltic coast. And so, to an degree, in this Cold War period, Poland becomes a much more homogeneous state. As we know, because of the Holocaust, the Jewish population almost disappears in Poland. Not completely, but there's still a small community. But it's not what it once was. It was the largest Jewish population in the world lived in Poland. Now, what happens afterwards now is you have Poland that's 90%, over 90% Polish ethnic and Catholic. So it's a whole different state. And immigration is cut off again because the communists don't want people leaving and the Americans don't want them either. So there's this cutoff of immigration. So in Chicago, the community looks inward and once again becomes very anti-communist, breaks off relations with the communist regime, eventually starts to do cultural issues and opens that door a little bit, which, and then of course, with the election of John Paul to the papacy and then like Valença and all those periods of turmoil in the 80s and 90s, you get the decline and the destruction of the Soviet Empire. Today, Poles don't come to Chicago, right? Because they're part of the EU. It's easier to go to Brussels. There are 13 buses a day from Poznań to Brussels. You can work in Brussels. You can work in France. You can work in Germany. You can come home for the weekend and see your grandmother. And there's no visa. There's no passport that has to be issued. And so why travel to Chicago? In fact, many Poles have returned, especially those who have retired on Social Security, et cetera. And so it's a whole different world now. And you see the sort of physical decline of the community. And that is true also for Lithuanians Czechs, of course. But you see much more assimilation and Americanization and interethnic marriage in this post-war period.
Right. Tobias, do you want to make some final points before we end for today?
I think it's a story of contradiction. So the post-war period, the second half of the 20th century is a period of decline for Chicago because of deindustrialization. Many of the immigrants and their descendants are actually leaving the city. They move to the suburbs. Many Jews leave Chicagoland and move to Southern California and Florida. Others move to the northern suburbs. That's the big story, essentially. Dominic mentioned the DP Act in 1948, so that's significant. The United States, for the first time in 1948, actually recognizes refugees as legitimate migrants who can enter the country. But the people behind this legislation are anti-Semitic and they're anti-Catholic and anti-Polish. Well, not anti-Catholic. The main sponsor is Patrick McCarran, who's a senator from Nevada, and he makes sure that Jews and Poles are excluded. And it takes until 1950 before this is really liberalized. And so that's also explained why many Poles who were displaced go to Britain rather than to the United States. It's not a good story, I have to say. And ironically, the post-war period for these immigrants from Eastern Europe, and at this point, it's mostly their descendants, is actually a good period because they do better. They're moving into the middle class. They often live in the suburbs. Some stay in the city. And of course, the situation in Eastern Europe is bad. Most Jews were killed in the Holocaust. So there's very little connection. Eastern Europe is an imagined place. That's sort of the beginning of this romanticization of the shtetl. And there's a rupture, a complete rupture in the Jewish case. In the Polish case, that's very different, right? Because Poland is still existing. It is actually still possible to travel from Poland to Chicago, and Poles do that, and they migrate, even in the communist period. I find that quite interesting, something I learned as a child. All you needed was a certain amount of dollars, and you could actually then get an immigration visa. And I think the communist government also saw some economic benefit in that. So there's still links there. But in the Jewish case, there's really a rupture. And again, it's really important to point out in all these groups, Ukrainians and Lithuanians, it's even worse. They're in the Soviet Union. There's no links. There's no travel. Jews trying to leave the Soviet Union are facing a lot of hurdles. While the Greek case is interesting again, right? We have these communities in Chicago also. Greece is in a horrific civil war in the late 40s, and then becomes a tourist destination. And so it's very visible in Chicago. I just want to mention that because the Greeks are often overlooked. They are very much part of this. And what is also interesting, Chicago is sort of almost a failing city. It doesn't become Detroit, but it retains enormous political influence in Washington in this period. So some of the most important congressmen are from Chicago. Almost every world leader who visits the United States visits Chicago. I mean, it's because of these ethnic communities there that retain enormous influence because of their size. And also in state politics, obviously, Chicago dominates the state. So there's a real legacy of that immigration to this very day in that regard. And we haven't talked much about African-Americans. They're sort of on the sidelines. And it is the story of how African-Americans gradually moved to the center in Chicago, I think. And it's partly because the immigrants moved out in their descendants.
We have episodes for African-American history as well, and women. So, and actually, as we go through all these groups, I feel very bad because we briefly mentioned the Greeks today, but we did not mention the Cypriots. And I go to Cyprus every year, and one man I met who owns a winery there, he said, "Oh, you have an accent from Chicago." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I went to school there." And then he went back and took over his father's winery in Cyprus. So these connections are so many, and they all go back to Chicago. The last time I was in Poland skiing in Zakopane, one of the Polish ski instructors I met spent many years in Chicago as well. So Chicago still, maybe if not a point that people want to settle to, many Eastern Europeans still have a connection through friends, family, somehow to Chicago. So, Tobias, Dominic, we have to end for today. That was fantastic, but I want to give both of you the opportunity to plug some of your projects. Why don't we start with you, Tobias?
Yeah, so I worked in Chicago a lot for the sort of the German-Jewish connection, but I used this history for my new forthcoming book about Jewish migration from Eastern Europe, because in a sense, some of the key characters in the book were connected to Chicago, and that really helped me a great deal to understand these connections. So yeah, I mean, Chicago continues to fascinate me, and it's really connected to global history in very interesting ways.
And Dominic, why don't you tell us a little bit more about your project at the Chicago History Museum and your Back of the Yards Museum?
We've opened up Come Home Chicago, Polish Chicago, at the Chicago History Museum. It'll run till June 7th or 8th, something like that. It is the first large exhibit on the Polish community in Chicago and a major museum not connected ethnically. So it's a big step for Polonia, I think. It deals with the migration process, all three of the major migrations before World War One, the displaced persons and the Solidarity immigration, and the relationship with Poland as it developed over time. And it's based largely on my book American Warsaw, which came out in 2019. The Packingtown Museum is in an old packing house at the edge of the stockyards. It was not a kill floor, but it was a pork packing house. And it is the home of a food industry incubator, a man named John Edel, as an Edelweiss. And Edel is a good friend. And he said to me, why don't we build this stockyard museum? And we did. And it's a small museum, but it was voted the best little museum in Chicago to learn Chicago history by Chicago Magazine. And we're open all the time. It's free. You can come in and take a look and walk around. And it's largely photos and maps and other kinds of collections. But it tells a story of the meatpacking industry. And Chicago dominated the meatpacking industry for almost, more than 100 years. Today is basically gone, though it is located now. It is the stockyard itself is the largest industrial park in the city of Chicago, the most successful. 15,000 men and women still work in the stockyards, some in meatpacking, but mostly in other kinds of industries. So if you can come down and take a look at our museum and to the Chicago History Museum and see both of our exhibits. Thank you.
So yeah, head down to the Chicago History Museum to see Back Home, Polish Chicago at the Chicago History Museum through June 7th or 8th, 2024. And also, whenever you want to, head over to the Packingtown Museum in Chicago's Back of the Arts neighborhood. You will be warmly welcomed. All right, Dominic, Tobias, thank you so very much, and thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you. Bye.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.